Thank you, Professor Britt, members and friends of the Creative Advertising Workshop. It's a great pleasure for me to be with you this evening. Whenever I see so many potential clients, I'm usually moved and compelled to make a presentation, but I shall not do it tonight. Instead, I'm going to talk to you about how long will the Negro market last? You know, I'm always talking to friends, and they're saying to me, now that integration is coming, when will Ebony go out of business? And my answer is always, why do Negroes always have to go out of business when integration comes? Why can't life go out of business, or look go out of business? Or or anybody go out of business except us. In delving into some historical material for this address, it was interesting to note that the advertising industry was born in a conflict that involved the Negro and the nature and destiny of our country. The first advertisement in an American periodical is said to have been run in Andrew Bradford's Weekly Mercury, a Philadelphia newspaper, on December 29th, 1719, one Philip Ludwell advertised in the Mercury for the return of a runaway slave. Today, 245 years later, the advertising industry, the Negro, and America are again bracketed in a dialogue of destiny. Today, as in 1719, the Negro is again at the center of a conflict in the heart of our marketplace. This conflict is, in essence, a crisis in meaning and communication, and it cannot be solved without the help and the support of the men who deal in the meaning of communications. The crisis is a basic challenge to our ingenuity and to our inventiveness. I am heartened, however, by the fact that Americans, especially American advertisers, have been fruitful in meeting the challenges. Now, over the years, advertisers have successfully confronted a series of revolutions. The Negro Revolution is not the first. The changing status of the American woman, for example, the explosion of the metropolis, and the continuing revolutions in leisure and in transportation. In confronting these social upheavals, advertisers have enriched and changed the thinking of all Americans. Now, we are called upon today to make a comparable shift in our thinking and feeling. More than 100 years ago, at a moment not unlike our present crisis, Abraham Lincoln said, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so must we think anew and act anew." The revolution of rising expectations in America has created a new occasion, calling for new approaches and new answers. The crisis we face today is a direct result of a basic split in our nation, a split that is reflected in the American marketplace. The social revolution is forcing us to reappraise and reevaluate our approaches to see if the dogmas and the techniques of the quiet past are adequate to the new and stormy present. I should like to suggest to you tonight that we confront our new occasion not as a problem, but as an opportunity for reorientation, rediscovery, and renewal. It is gratifying for me to note that some advertisers are approaching the crisis in this spirit. The use of Negro and white models in all media to reflect the Negro's real position in the economy is the latest in a series of steps that began in the late 40s with Ebony and other media oriented to Negro consumers. Since that time, the industry has demonstrated an increasing willingness to confront the implications of the huge Negro market. I need only refer you to your TV sets and to your newspapers to remind you that all of a sudden we now see Negroes included in many situations, in courtroom scenes and hospitals and street scenes, and these kind of things are long overdue, and we're very happy to see them. Now today, with the passage of the civil rights legislation and the beginning of a transitional period of desegregation and token integration, some advertisers are asking, is the Negro market necessary? And if it is necessary, how long will it last? These questions, I think, betray a fundamental understanding not only of the Negro market, but of the white market. At this crucial hour, it is important for every advertiser to understand how the Negro market came into being and why it exists today as a separate market. Let us begin with a simple question. What is a market? A market, according to information supplied by marketing specialists, is an aggregate buying force for focused selling by quantitative or qualitative indices such as age, common interests, status, and geographical location. The usual market dividers or demographic factors, we are told, are income, occupation, sex, education, and in the case of certain minorities, racial origin. There are transitional markets, such as the teenage market, and there are permanent markets based on physical factors, such as the female market. And there is, we shall see, a Negro market. Now, the basic premise of the modern advertising concept of the market is that the persons classified for focused selling respond to advertising messages in markedly different ways because of social, cultural, and psychological factors related to their situation. In the light of this definition, we can see quite clearly that the Negro market is a distinct geographical, social, and psychological reality based on physical factors and common experiences of exclusion and deprivation. The 20 million consumers in this market are Americans who share the same cultural environments as other Americans, but they are also Negroes, which means that they are almost by definition excluded from full participation in the culture. Identified as Negroes at birth, forced to live, think, buy, breathe, and die as Negroes, Americans with a certain past and a certain skin color come in time to see themselves as Negro people. The key elements here are forced identification and forced exclusion. The Negro must identify with his group. He has no choice. He cannot move into the dominant culture unless he ceases to be a Negro, or unless the dominant culture ceases to be white. The Negro's identification is total and final. He cannot resign. This is the background against which we must view the Negro market. One passes out of the teenage market. One moves from the mass market to the class market, from one status to another, based on the appropriation of certain skills, certain goods, certain values, or the passage of time. But one is born a Negro and one remains a Negro, no matter how much money one acquires or how many degrees that one earns. Geographically as well as socially, Negro consumers are set apart. The Negro community, a physical as well as a psychological reality, is concentrated at the present time in the urban areas, where most of our wholesale and retail transactions are made. Negro consumers, it should be noted, are not concentrated by choice. The Negro community, the base of the Negro market, grew out of the seed experience of slavery and Reconstruction and the development of a color caste system, which relegated all Negro people to the lower caste and forbade social intercourse and intermarriage between the two castes. As a result of this development, America was split into two communities, composed of one group with a white orientation and a second group excluded from identification with the white community and the media servicing that community. The Negro market, therefore, is not a special market within the white market. It is, on the contrary, a general market defined precisely by its exclusion from the white market. The Negro general market, in fact, includes all other special markets, including teenage, female, mass, and class markets. Within the Negro market are Negro millionaires and Negro paupers, Negro Jews and Negro Catholics. What unites these groups is a common consciousness of a common past and a common participation, a common anticipation of a common fate. And this consciousness affects every Negro, from Ralph Bunch to the humblest porter. The Negro consumer, whatever his location, has the same problems, the same hopes as any other American of his status and income level, and the additional problems of color caste. The middle-class Negro, for example, has middle-class hopes and middle-class anxieties, and Negro hopes and Negro anxieties. This double vision, this bifocal scrutiny of all messages and communications creates a peculiar problem in communications and in selling. Repeated studies have shown marked differences in the purchase patterns of the two communities. Because of real and continuing deprivations in their lives, Negro consumers tend to think, buy, and act in significantly different ways than white consumers who are not burdened by the necessity of viewing life through two sets of glasses. Psychologically, geographically, socially, and economically, the Negro market is a distinct reality with a definite character. This market, to sum up, is general, and it includes segments of all other markets. It is permanent, based in the main on permanent disabilities, linked irrationally to a physical factor, skin color. It is definitive in the orientation of the consumer, and it is important. Consisting of 20 million consumers with an annual purchasing power of some $24 billion. This market is important today, and it will be even more important tomorrow. According to population experts, at least a dozen of our large cities will be 50% Negro within the next 10 or 15 years. At that time, if not at the present, the Negro market will be a controlling factor in the profit margins of every major American corporation. We have demonstrated, I think, that this market exists and that it is important. Let us now ask ourselves, how long will it last? To ask this question is to ask, how long will the white market last? It is to ask, how long will Harlem last? It is to ask the ultimate question about the meaning and the destiny of American civilization. The Negro market cannot and will not disappear until the white market disappears, until all external barriers to the free movement of people and goods are torn down, and until all internal barriers and stereotypes are forgotten. To put it another way, the Negro market will last as long as one Negro buyer is denied the right to spend his money and to choose his companions and his style of life because of an accident of color. A great deal of confusion surrounding this question stems from a misunderstanding of the words desegregation and integration. The two words refer to two entirely different realities. We are today in the first phase of a transitional period of desegregation. This means the tearing down of the legal walls of discrimination and segregation. We are a long way from real integration, which would involve the merging of differences, physical and social, and the assimilation of all groups into a whole. In an integrated society, there would be complete social mobility based on class rather than caste, and a free movement of people and goods based on free choices of individuals. Myrdal, Warner, and other sociologists and students of our divided society say that we cannot transcend our current dilemma as long as the American social definition of the Negro remains the same. In other words, the definition is that any person with Negro ancestors is a Negro. Under this condition, according to these experts, the movement or expansion of population and markets must of necessity be in the direction of the non-white population. This, as you can see, sheds a great deal of light on our topic for the day, how long will the Negro market last? The myth of the melting pot has obscured the reality of American life. As Glazier and Moynihan pointed out in the recent book, Beyond the Melting Pot, we have not yet begun to assimilate the Negro and other minorities who are listed in the census reports under the separate category of non-whites. Not only is the Negro not melting, he has not been permitted to get into the pot. The Negro is not melting in America, he is multiplying. The ghetto is not shrinking, it is exploding. Negro-oriented media came into being as a protest against separateness, and we look forward to the day when there will be a community which means communications. As I indicated before, someone asked me, for example, what would happen to Ebony and other Negro media in an age of real integration. And I told them quite frankly that real integration would pose a sharper problem for white-oriented media than for Ebony and other Negro publications. For real and meaningful integration, and Brazil is an example, would lead to a society closer to the current image of Ebony than to the image of any contemporary white-oriented media. But this is a problem of tomorrow and not of today. What the Negro's consumer wants now is a recognition of their humanity, an industry-wide respect for the Negro image. What they want above all is fair play in the public sectors of our economy. No Negro consumer asks for more. Few, if any, Negro consumers are willing to take less. The turbulent decades ahead will require special care in the programming of appeals to the Negro market, which is growing more complex hour by hour. Negro consumers, in fact, are growing not less self-conscious, but more self-conscious. As more doors open, Negro consumers are becoming agonizingly conscious of the doors that are still closed. The central dynamic at work here is David Reisman's principle of the more, the more. The more Negroes consumers gain, the more they want. The more they win, the more they want to win. And the more critical they become of media and products and services that deny them an acceptable image. This process is likely to continue as the Negro consumer approaches his goals. And it's interesting to note that this is not just true of the Negro minority, this is true of all minorities. The basic factor here is the migrating mood of Negro consumers who have a new appreciation of themselves as non-whites. When we started our business at Ebony, we used to have a hard time finding very dark Negro models. Now we have a very hard time finding very light Negro models. The emphasis is on black. The emphasis is on race. And I think this is as it should be. This is not anti-white. This is pro-Negro. And I think a man first has to believe in himself before he can encourage and sell other people on the idea of believing in him. It's a kind of a religion which we first have to believe in ourselves, and then we're able to impart this to others. The increasing sensitivity of Negro consumers and their increasing importance in urban markets call for not a token, but a complete revamping of our sales strategies. It seems to me that we have been prematurely concerned with technique rather than understanding. Technique alone will not bridge the communications gap between the Negro and the white communities. Not only our technique, but the attitude and images that inform our techniques must change. What is required now is a total response based on a new kind of knowledge, namely an imaginative experiencing of the basic problems and goals of the Negro consumer. And this is why I indicated that white media would have more of a problem in a truly integrated society than Negro media would have, because it will be a question of serving the total community. And the Negro people have had more experience serving the white community than they have had serving us. So actually, Ebony should do a better job of serving the white community than the other media could do serving the Negro community. For some advertisers, this will involve a remaking of the whole image of the company. For others, it will mean a deeper appreciation of what the product or service means within the context of the consumer's life and group history and the goals the consumer is trying to express through the use of product or service. Company images must be changed by projection of a sense of concern for all consumers in all media at all times. It is not enough to integrate our ads. We must also integrate our vision. Because of present limitations of structure and base, Negro consumers cannot be reached and effectively sold in media that ignore the vital dimensions of their lives. By meeting Negro consumers halfway, by recognizing their increasing sensitivity to images and symbols, by decreasing their feeling of isolation from the mainstream, advertisers help not only themselves, but America. To improve the image of the Negro in the white community and the image of the white person in the Negro community is to improve the image of the company. Now, I recognize that we have some problems, not just with whites. We also have some problems with Negroes. I recall that some years ago, we employed our first white advertising writer on the magazine, editorial writer on the magazine, and there was quite a conference and quite a discussion on how we would handle the problem. I recall that we had some petitions in the office, and they finally had a meeting with me, and they wanted to know, well, if we employ this white fella, will he be in charge of anybody? And their feeling was, is that whenever Negroes are employed by white companies, we are never initially put in charge of anybody. And so they thought he ought to start at the bottom and work his way up. Something like the stock room or the shipping room or someplace like that. Then there was the question of, would he be permitted to go out with Negro girls? And I said, well, gee, you know, that wouldn't really be for me to say. I mean, to go out with Negro girls if they want to go out with him and so forth, and if he wants to go out with them. And then the key question was, where will he sit in the office? Most people agreed that he should not be permitted to sit in the front of the office. So we finally compromised and permitted him to sit in the middle of the office. So I recognize that we do have problems on each side, and of course it was rather inconvenient because there were certain little stories that we told about white people that we had to be careful about. And so very often when we mix our employees, we have to be careful. So now people have to look around and be certain that the white employee is in another part of the building and whatnot. But the interesting thing about this was that after a while, once they got used to the idea, they quit telling the stories, and they find it very convenient and very easy to get along with. The other problem was, of course, when we employed the first white girl, we had a problem because she said that the Negro girls were not friendly. As a matter of fact, she wanted to leave after 2 months because she had been there 2 months and she hadn't been able to make a single friend. So I called some Negro girls together and I said, well, you know, why haven't you been friendly with this young lady? And they said, well, she hasn't been friendly with us. And so it had to be pointed out that in a case like this, it is the responsibility of the majority to hold out the hand of friendship to the minority. So what we arranged to do was to have a kind of an invisible committee, which arranged to have lunch with a white employee and to see that they met other employees there in the office and to stay with them until they were able to make their own friends. In other words, it had to be planned. And I think the same thing will be true in any kind of integrated situation. We have to plan it. It has to have the authority from the top. We have to be serious about it. And it is always the responsibility of the majority to hold out the friendship to the minority group. So that I think it is important in writing the ads and in employing people in our companies to meet the challenge and to fulfill our promise so that in the end we will create a market that will be neither black nor white. The advertising industry is a business, but it is also a vital social and economic force in our lives. It would not be true, perhaps, to say that as the advertising industry goes, so goes America. But it would not be far from the truth to say that America cannot go very far in any direction without the help and support of the advertising industry. Now, at the turning of the decisive fork, America needs the advertising industry's ingenuity and inventiveness. And to quote the ethics of the fathers from the Talmud, the time is short, the hour is late, the matter is urgent. It is not incumbent upon us to complete the task, but neither are we free to desist from doing all that we possibly can. Thank you.
I think I'll have to let you take this off. I won't be able to put it in here.